Welcome to Sound Healing Radio. My name's David Gibson, and I'm here with Maestro Curtis. Maestro is one of the instructors at Globe Sound Healing Institute. He teaches music theory, inner music theory, and the relationship of music theory to consciousness and the like. Welcome, Maestro.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I wanted to, you know, what we do on each of the shows is we'll set an intention, mm-hmm. and then we hold that intention throughout the show, tapping back into it.
That's great.
Do you have anything in mind? I've got something in mind if you don't have anything that comes to mind right away.
Well, I'm willing to just go with the flow.
Okay, so I was thinking grounding with love.
Great. I'm all for that.
Grounding with love. Okay, so it's interesting because when I say that, the sound I hear is like, oh.
Something like that. That's a beautiful sound. Omen is a really good sound and a good way to start. So I'm ready whenever you're ready.
Cool. Well, what I'd like first is to tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to get interested in the field of sound therapy and sound healing.
Well, I guess I have a big background in jazz and classical and gospel music, which all have a very spiritual base as far as the intentions are concerned. With jazz, there's not only the spiritual side, but the intellectual side of things. So basically what I'm getting at is that I guess we were always dealing with sacred geometry and sound healing on some level or another. And being a musician originally from New Orleans, I've just migrated to the West where it definitely is the best because of the like minds out here who are just gravitating towards, you know, seeking and healing. And just to make a long story short, how I really got into sound healing was through the vehicle of gospel music. I was one of the supervisors at an adult day health center that took care of seniors who had either mentally ill problems or physical problems. And what I was in charge of was actually recreational therapy and music therapy. The music therapy situation actually happened as an accident. I just kind of stumbled into it. Basically what happened was my background's in piano and vocal music, and I would come in and just sort of, I guess you could use the old saying, music soothes the savage beast. What I would do is I would come in, and for the people with dementia and Alzheimer's, I would come in and just, you know, play the piano and, you know, sing a little bit for them, you know, and try to, you know, connect with them on some level. And you could see that the music really was getting through to, I would probably say, 99.9% of the people, music being a universal vehicle. And one day, I was sitting at the piano, and I was playing some stride piano stuff, and going in and out of just classical pieces and stride piano specifically. And so what happened was there was a guy there who had been sitting there, and he got up and came and sat down by me on the actual piano bench. And, you know, I didn't say anything. I said, okay, I just kind of scooted over and was playing with for him. And then he said, that's interesting. And he started talking to me about, you know, the fact that he had played over in Europe and played in Russia and all these different places all over the world. Well, in this little room, kind of a, I guess you could say it was probably a room that was maybe 20 by 20, which is a small room to house about 15, 20 people in there with Alzheimer's and dementia. What they would do is lock the door. So you had this one little window that was inside the door, and that was all you had. Didn't have any light coming in or any of that. And so what I noticed was, as I was talking to the gentleman, Hoover was his last name. I could see people pulling each other and peering in the little window there, that was probably about 12 by 12 window, and I'm talking 12 inches. And so I thought that was kind of strange. So he asked me to scoot over, and when I scooted over, he began to play piano. So he's playing the piano, and then the next thing I knew, the director comes in, and she says, "Mr. Hoover, what are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, I'm here with my friend Maestro." And everybody, the nurses, the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, all came in and were in shock, because what had happened ostensibly was this man had not talked for 18 years to anyone. He broke his silence. And even today, it brings chills to me, and I almost want to come to tears, because as a musician, what happens is that when you come into an epiphany, these little epiphanies happen, but when you come into something that grand and that great and that auspicious, what it does is it lets you know that you have a purpose beyond what you think you've been toying with. And so for me, it put me on the path of sound healing and music therapy. And ever since then, I've not looked back.
So did you continue working with the Alzheimer's
patient? Well, what happened was the director, she said, "This is sort of like therapy." And I said, "Yeah, music therapy." Well, before that, I hadn't even heard the term music therapy. I didn't know that people had been delving into music therapy and doing things like that. So what happened was she had been doing some work with United Way and toying with some grants and doing things. And when I used the word music therapy, she asked me to help her to write a grant. Eventually what happened was I did a proposal and a presentation before the United Way committee here in San Francisco, and they funded our program for 5 years.
How did it work? Did you have a lot of...
In the beginning, because it was new for me, it was sort of like a hit and miss. But what happened one night was I thought about the fact that in order for this program to really work, I'm going to need some clinical psychologists, some psychiatrists, some physicians, and to bring in just the whole clinician, the clinical aspect of it. And when I began to sit down with the social workers and give them my ideas about, you know, where I wanted to go with this, the program just took off. And what we saw was, as I studied more and more, we were dealing with what was called memory sensory stimulation. And when you deal with Alzheimer's and dementia, ostensibly what's going on is that the short-term memory is has some very serious issues. The long-term memory is almost still intact. And so what we were able to do was to do things like teach people their phone numbers by, you know, putting them in the nursery rhymes and, you know, things of that nature, and like remembering people's names, doing familiar songs. And what we would do is we would do a case study of that particular individual's history. What kind of music particular person like as they were growing up? And, you know, we would interview their wives, their husbands, their children, uncles, aunts, to find out what kind of music this person liked. And when we were able to do that, we were able to take that vehicle to get in and to get their attention. And in doing so, we were able to fine-tune our technique and our process.
So it sounds like music actually enhances the short-term memory?
Along with diet, nutrition is a vital part. You know, over the years we've been finding out that to cook with things like aluminum pots and pans and things of that nature causes severe Alzheimer's. So we were able to take all of the studies and bring them all together under one you know, formula, and basically just sat down and with all of the team, everyone that was on the team, and to do an evaluation of that person to help that person to at least function, you know, to be productive again.
Wow. It's amazing. Do you know of other programs that are doing this now at all?
You know, I don't know on this, on the level that we were doing it. What, you know, during the time that I was really, you know, heading that program, I was doing some correspondence and some networking with other institutes all over the United States. And I shared a lot of, you know, the information that I had gathered over the years with them. And I know some of the institutes have been doing some groundbreaking things with music theory, music therapy, such as the Goldman Institute in San Francisco, for certain. And then the Institute on Aging in San Diego was another one.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's really a, truly, just a, an amazing thing that seems like there should be more research in the field to really see exactly what's going on, because yes, there's so little known about Alzheimer's. I just heard a program just last week where they're saying it's amazing how little is still known exactly what's going on with it.
You know, I agree, and you know what's, I think the most crucial thing is that, you know, our seniors are a plethora, a wealth of knowledge, you know, and it's just a shame that we've come to the point in our society where we just kind of push them aside, and we, you know, we spend more time on youth and, you know, and not connecting the two. And so with that, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, our government programs have been cut that, you know, support a lot of the funding for these particular institutions.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we're also, we've set up the Sound Healing Research Foundation, the nonprofit at the school that we're just developing now. We've got the nonprofit set up. And, you know, if anybody's interested in this area and like, would like to, you know, work on it, you know, maybe they could give us a call and we could connect them with you.
Well, I'd be more than glad to network with anyone that's interested. You know, over the years, I always run into people who have read, you know, my background. And whether I'm in airports or in, you know, at conferences or, you know, whatever the case is. And, you know, Alzheimer's and dementia affects, we're looking at 92.3% of the population eventually will have someone that they will come in contact in their family, in their lifetime, that has dealt with, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's. And so I get people who ask me questions about it all the time, and I always tell them, you know, pay attention to things like dietary, you know, supplements. There's some supplements out there that are really, really good. A lot of fish, if they could eat certain kinds of fish, your omega-3s, and music.
I just heard, I didn't hear the details, but I just heard yesterday about a patch that just came out for people with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm not really, I've been hearing a lot about it, and I have seen advertisements on it, actually, over the internet and on television. And I haven't really delved into that, and my wife and I were actually talking about that, because I'm actually dealing with an uncle right now who's looks like he's going to have to be institutionalized because of severe Alzheimer's.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it just, again, it kind of just brings out the incredible power of sound and music, that it's amazing how little we do know and how much research there is to be done. And, but you've been, you know, I can say you're one of the most amazing keyboard players I've ever met.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
And the amount of music theory background, I mean, you've worked with, God, so many people, including Count Basie and Earth, Wind and Fire guys, and so many different people. And, you know, the main thing that I'm curious about is, you know, the relationship of consciousness and different states of consciousness to different music and different, even down, I mean, there's really, I always see it as three levels. I see it as sound, and then musical intervals, and then music itself, which is rhythm and changing musical intervals.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as far as sound, I mean, there's a component specific archetypal sounds have been shown to create specific effects.
Right.
You know, like 45 hertz affects the bones and regenerates the bones. There's been a study in Russia. And then there's also the certain gongs are tuned to certain frequencies, and then even the frequency of planets are used in the tuning forks by Acutonics.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's musical intervals. Now, what can you tell us about how musical intervals affect us?
Well, there is absolutely a physiological and a psychological, change that occurs when sounds are either harmonically or melodically played. And so, if you go back to the ancient Egyptian mystery schools, where I guess you could say this is the first concept of what was called mood music. And what they would basically do is they would use what we call today the modes, which are the ancient Egyptian modes. What they would actually do is, in these Egyptian mystery schools, the scientists would take an individual, or take individuals in various rooms, and they would evoke certain emotions. Like, say, for instance, in room A, the emotion that they would try to provoke or evoke would be, say, happiness or joy. And then in another room, maybe over in Studio B or room B, we say sadness, just to have a contrast. And then maybe say in three, we have love. And then what they would do is they would measure the heart rates. And from the heart rate, they created the actual rhythmical pattern of the drum beat, so that they would have a tempo as well as an actual drum beat. And then from that, they would take these Egyptian modes, which they had experimented with for years, knowing that they created certain moods. And they would take these modes and play these modes in various arrangements over this music, creating various moods. And it's the actual interval, which is the relationship from one note to another, that helped to create, to heal, to evoke, to provoke certain kinds of physiological and psychological effects. And so we do know, and it's been proven, even scientists starting to delve into things using sound and interval distances to create certain kinds of projects and certain kinds of scientific experiments. So we do know that the interval plays an extremely important aspect in how the music, first of all, reaches our body. It communicates with our cells, it communicates with the molecular structure and the atomic structures of our body. So it's been very interesting.
I was thinking it might be fun to kind of play with some of the intervals. Can we do that?
I'm not near a piano or anything. I'm just actually sitting inside my car.
Oh, okay. Could you just sing like a musical fifth?
Okay. if we were to do a scale, I'd say, and here again, I'm a little rough right now. My throat's a little out of it, but I'll sing a little, just a little bit. Right? So if we were singing the intervals of the major scale, let's say, in ancient times it was called Ionian. And the Ionian interval would be a whole interval, then a half interval, whole, and then another half. And so it would sound a little bit like this. And I'm sure our listeners out there are somewhat familiar with the scale degrees. It would do something like this. The last ah being the octave. That's the fifth. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 5. Would
so
be the
my
fifth.
Understanding is that's besides the octave, which is, you know, for those of you that don't know, the octave is C to C, or and also an octave is double the frequency as well.
Mm-hmm.
But besides the octave, I know that the musical fifth is the most harmonious interval there is.
Right. That's correct.
And now it's interesting because, you know, I just had someone recently that said that they got some crystal bowls, and then they were playing with the bowls, and they didn't really like a lot of the musical intervals, and because they were too dissonant. And I said to them, which is kind of an interesting thing around the school, is dissonance is really just a perceptual thing. And it's interesting because there's been a lot of kind of discussion about this recently. A lot of our instructors at the school don't believe in dissonance. They believe that dissonance is just activation.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the most dissonant musical interval?
The most dissonant musical interval. Well, I happen to be one of those ones who
don't believe in the
musical background.
It's all beautiful.
As far as I'm concerned, it really is.
Uh-huh.
Of course, in mathematical terms and in the way that they've taught us over the years, there certainly is dissonance as far as what we've been taught in the academic world. But as far as I'm concerned, a lot of that stuff, David, I've pretty much thrown away because if it works, I use it.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, just to bring it home, there's, I mean, like a car horn or an alarm or probably the most dissonant sound I would think of is the emergency broadcast system tone that comes on TV. Like,
right.
Whereas, you know, that's very close to a bagpipe, which is actually a very beautiful instrument.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I grew up being a person who was in love with Thelonious Monk as one of my idols. And when you talk about dissonance and you talk about just restructure, he really turned my head around when it comes to putting certain sounds together and creating, you know, different tones for various purposes. And so over the years and working in therapy and working in Alzheimer's and just as a musician, all-around musician, some of the stuff that I've done over the years has been a channeling situation, and then some of it has been sort of revolutionary in the way that to break away from the structure of things and to expand and to move into new areas. And so you'll never know what something can do if you don't use it, or if you don't experiment, or if you don't expand. And so to be caught in a certain structure, I, for a long time, have not acquiesced to that mode of thinking.
I'm sorry?
And for a long time, I've not found myself, in that school of thought for years,
uh-huh,
because I want to remain open.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the way we teach about it at the school, of course, is the difference between calming and activation.
Oh, yes, of course.
You know, and you can tie that into to the different diseases that people have or different maladies that people have. Because,
you know,
if you've got, if someone's got depression or someone is just tired, you know, doesn't even have anything, they're just tired, you know, to play just really super melodic music with sounds that have even harmonic structure, which are very calming, like a like the harp.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, someone that's depressed may never get out of bed.
Right.
Whereas, you know, on the other hand, if you're too activating, you know, you can make it so it's I mean, if you have too much, well, activation, I guess, which is what a lot of people, I mean, that's the way I think of dissonance, is just activation.
Right.
And it's, then that can, you know, for people that have nervous disorders, it can really put them over the edge.
I agree. You know, there's a gentleman who invented an apparatus called the emissions. It's called the molecular emissions detector or something of that nature. And what it does is that you could point it at anything, and it can give you the exact numbers of that particular entity or being or object. And I always thought it'd be interesting to own one of those things. I understand it costs $50,000. But from the standpoint of healing, if you could aim it at yourself, let's just say one day you had a common cold, and let's just say maybe you are, you operated at an optimum of an A. Oh, yeah, an A. And let's say you pointed this thing on you and you had a cold, and maybe you were a G or an A flat. The possibilities of using this device would be that you could continue to point it at yourself until you begin to tweak yourself back into your healthy, you know, fun, loving self again. Or if you have depression, to use it for, you know, the purposes of that.
Well, do you know, so it sounds like it's actually picking up your soul frequency or your root frequency or whatever frequency you're emanating.
That's what I heard. You know, and you know, I studied with Randy Masters. I learned a lot from Randy, and we've had conversations about this thing. He and I actually have been talking about maybe going in half on one. So it would be really interesting to have this device.
Uh-huh. You know, it's interesting because it makes me think about the musical structure of the chakras.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, originally, I mean, most people face the chakras on C, and then they go up whole steps all the way up to B for the crown chakra.
Right.
And then, you know, it always occurred to me that it would make more sense if the chakras were based on the harmonic structure of sound, which we find in every cell, we find in the distance between the planets, the mathematical structure is basically mathematical multiples. So if you got a frequency that's like the root, which is like, then the harmonic would be, the second harmonic would be double that, and then
mm-hmm.
the third harmonic would be triple that. So it'd be like,
right.
So it seems like, you know, that would make more sense. But then the Chinese actually used musical fists as
right.
each of the chakras. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I can say this, that there's a lot of information out there regarding the whole chakra system. In fact, now we're looking at, you know, over the years we've been taught that there's been only these seven chakras. And now we're looking at sub-chakras and, you know, sub-sub-chakras. You know, basic vortexes in the body that are energy serving systems. So, you know, I think right now we're living in times where there's a lot of information out there that I believe is being transmitted so that we can, you know, have a lot to draw from. I don't think there's any one specific conclusion yet. I don't think the jury's in on all of this as of yet. But I do see the chakra system and using harmonics as a very useful way of getting to activating the certain the specific systems in the body. So and actually at Globe, we're we've been doing some some real I guess we did healing through activating chakras, and we're still learning. So I don't think the jury's in on that yet.
Tell us about the classes you teach.
I teach music theory from a psychoacoustics inner sound perspective, and that is to take the music and the sounds around us and to understand why they work, why they have a physiological and psychological effect. It's one thing to say, okay, that Smokey Robinson is responsible for the baby boom. As we know that music has a loving effect and certainly an erotic effect. But what we do is we get into what the numbers mean and how to take your intention and to use specific modalities, intervals, to help create sound healing situations. And that's basically what I do from a music theory perspective, is to delve deeper and to, facilitate our students who come in taking their music, taking their ideas, and using them in a sound healing atmosphere. We get massage therapists who come in who say, I want to be able to take my practice and I want to be able to use some sound healing music with that. And so what we do is, in my particular classes, teach them various things about the meridians and how those meridians within the body relate to not only the chakras and not only sacred geometry, but how they can take certain notes that activate certain organs in the body and specifically certain muscular situations in the body as well as the cells in the body.
So can you tell us, I know you don't have a keyboard now, but can you explain a little bit more about the different modes? Because it seems to be an important aspect.
Well, if you were to have a piano in front of you, if you would take, let's say we took a C from C to C, using all of the white keys on the piano, it's called Ionian. And Ionian basically has a very, very happy feeling. It has a what we call a perfect unison or perfect one, a major second, a major third, a perfect fourth, a perfect fifth, major sixth, major seventh, and a perfect octave. And so it has a very bright feeling to it. Gives you such a happy feeling. And then we have the Dorian scale, which is the white keys starting from D to D, which has a major, has a minor third in it. So it has more of a slight little tension to it. And then we have the Phrygian mode, which has a diminished second or minor second and a minor third. So in the scheme of things, the more you alter the notes, the more it has a different physiological and psychological effect on you. Then we have the Lydian scale, and between the Lydian scale, Lydian has a sharp four, which has a sort of a kindred to a childlike, playing on the piano. And we find that Walt Disney, when he created the whole concept of Disneyland, just about all of the music that was written there was either written in the major scale or the Lydian scale. Quite naturally, if you were to play a minor mode or minor scale for a child, and I've done it myself, when we've had the blues playing, and I noticed my daughter just started crying for no reason at all. So we know that it does alter you. So when you're talking about Lydian, you're talking about bright and playful. Same thing with the major scale. And then we have the Mixolydian scale, which is from G to G, using all of the white keys on the piano. Now, this has a flatted seventh, which in the jazz world, we kind of call this, in the gospel world, we call this the dominant scale, or the we use this particular scale to create gospel music, R&B, country, western, blues. It's based on the dominant seventh. Then we have the Aeolian. Interesting about Aeolian is the way it's spelled and the way it sounds. It sounds like the word alien if you were to say it really fast. One thing about the Aeolian scale, it is the natural minor scale to the Ionian scale, and so it has those. Even though it's a minor scale, it has the characteristics and the feeling and the sound that's relative to that that Ionian. Then we have the Locrian scale, which is the or Locrian mode, which is the most exotic of all the modes. And not because it has a minor, it has a diminished second, it has a minor third, and it has a flatted five. So it has a certain feel to it that expresses more of that much more tension and minor feeling in it.
So how much do you think of this, the feelings that are evoked by the different modes, how much do you think is psychological based on our past experience and versus physiological?
Well, I believe all of it plays into all of it comes into play. To really get into this over the airwaves would be it would take probably 3 weeks to really get one's attention when it comes to how significant and what all of these different sounds and intervals evoke. Definitely, when we're talking about past lives and things of that nature, there's a lot of things that are going on with us that's associated with that, as well as, you know, how it's affecting us in the now. Not only how it affects us then, but how it's affecting us, you know, in our present state.
Do you think it's from basically, are you saying that it ties into the music that you were a part of in your past life?
I believe that.
Uh-huh. That makes sense.
Yeah, I certainly believe that. I believe that we're constantly evolving. And, what was then is now.
And it's interesting. It makes me wonder if people that did a certain style of music still do that same style of music. Or the question is, I wonder if Bach is now in a current life doing techno.
That's really not too far-fetched. I'm certainly a believer of that. So,
I always thought it was really funny that in the recording and mixing field, the classical music is, I mean, it's so, there's such strict rules as to how it's mixed and how it's done, you know.
Certainly. It's one of the, you're talking about sonata allegro form, so the structure of that. You know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, Beethoven was probably one of the first to really kind of stray away from it, in a sense. In a sense, he did, and in a sense, he didn't. It's sort of like, in those days, you know, they had court musicians who certainly were there to, as experts for the king. So they would dictate to the king what was supposed to be during that time. Kind of have that going on today, sort of like how the industry just dictates what they think is supposed to be the norm, and then they exploit it. Or even during those times, if you strayed from the sonata allegro form, let's say in a concert, people would be beheaded back then.
Wow, it's like It's like I know those Beethoven and those guys, if they had had like all these effects and tools that we have
these days,
you know, they would have used them. They would have been using backmasking and stuff on me. You know? I mean, if they could have, because they were on the edge.
Yeah, they
you know,
were.
And since there wasn't that around, and there was, as you say, there was all these different, you know, political and church rules.
Right.
You know, the whole world of classical music kind of got stuck in
right.
that realm.
Right. And, you know, eventually what happened is just, it reminds me of something my mother told me when I was, oh, you're just a romantic. What happened was, when they found out that these guys were such geniuses, and they didn't want to, you know, behead some of these guys because then they would be martyrs. So what they would do is they would just say, okay, well, that's no longer classical music. You're just a romantic. So they would say, oh, that's romantic. That's romanticism.
You know, what I'd like to do is if Melissa's there, to go ahead and have her play the recording of the crickets slowed down, and
mm-hmm.
we should be able to talk over it and talk about what's going on with it.
Okay.
Okay. If you're there, Melissa, go ahead and play it at starting around 2 minutes and 40 seconds in, and we'll talk. This is the sound of crickets that have been slowed down in time. See if it's going to happen. If not, this will continue here. So, I'll just continue until it comes on.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that I'm most interested in is really two things, and that is how sound and music evokes love,
mm-hmm.
and how sound and music connects you to spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're having a workshop called The Sound of Love, and it's
right.
about not only personal love, but about spiritual love, and it's coming up this next weekend, Saturday,
mm-hmm.
July 21st and 22nd, for the whole weekend. If anybody's
right.
interested, they can give us a call at 415, or actually they can just call the 800 number, 800-9000-MIX. That's 800-9000-MIX. Or 415-777-2-HUM, H-U-M, 2-H-U-M, which is 2486. Or you can go to their website, which is soundhealingcenter.com. And so, you know, there's certain music that it's just, even without the lyrics, I mean, lyrics do a lot. I mean, they can really, really just, you know, I mean, they can just really make me just weep.
Right.
You know, but it's the music. I mean, there's a lot of music, like even Paco Belcanin, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of various music that just completely seems to evoke those feelings
mm-hmm.
without doing anything.
Right.
And you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I believe that the bottom line to all creation is intention.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put the right intention into it. And, you know, not only that, you know, I've seen things happen as an accident where the intention wasn't there.
Uh-huh.
So what am I saying? I'm saying, well, it could be either or. But sometimes, if you don't understand something, you can still be channeled through and directed
uh-huh.
to bring that tenderness and that sensitivity and that healing. But the overall intention has to be the basis of all of it. And how do you get to intention? First of all, you have to meditate and hold that field of love as the premise and the bottom line of that particular piece, so that no matter what happens, it doesn't stray from the basic intention of it. As far as I'm concerned, that has to be the bottom line, you know, and you have to hold that feel.
You can't write a song about love if you're not feeling it.
That's right. But it's been done. It's being done all the time.
uh-huh.
But, you know, the true higher self knows. The true higher self always comes through.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't matter what your intention is. It sooner or later, the truth always comes You know,
it makes me think of, there's so many songs that seem to have so much love in them that are not about love.
Right.
I mean, God, you know, it's really, really interesting.
Right.
You know, it's funny, I can tell you, one song that makes me weep as much as just about every time I hear it is, I don't even know the name of the song, it's about the fourth or fifth song off Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, where the women are just like, just screaming.
Right.
Just wailing. There's no lyric, they're just going, wah! You know, really just wailing.
Right.
And it's just, there's so much passion and emotion and sadness and all together in it. It's just,
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why is because the most organic experience that you can get to is through the human voice.
Mm-hmm. You know, I understand that you're working on an album that's a jazz album based around sound healing.
Right.
Tell us about it.
Well, I've been working on several albums. I still have an album that's soon to come out, and it's been a laboring experience because I just want this particular album to be, I want the intention to come across, and I don't want to put it out there. I've been pretty much pressured by the record company that I did this particular project under, and it's associated with Earth, Wind & Fire.
Uh-huh.
That particular album is called Eros. And the experience of Eros is I really wanted to come gleaming through the healing aspects and of sensuality and sexuality between two people. That's one project. And then this jazz healing project was a project that was I was approached by Soundshoe, who had asked me whether or not I was interested in doing a jazz album, a sound healing jazz album. I said, oh, that's interesting. Because, you know, during my studies with Randy Masters, I had already did all the sacred geometry with it, and all of the math and all of the intention, and was approached by Blue Note to do this particular record. And so it's this particular album, what it is, it's basically a piano trio kind of a situation whereby the emphasis is on the piano. And I've had my piano detuned to a frequency that's a lot more closer to the human experience. We know that in the late 1700s, they met in Europe to change the system to 440 so that everything would be relative to A440. Well, what I did was, at Randy's request, or so let's say Randy's suggestion, I detuned my piano to 432, which is a whole lot more warmer. The body reacts to it a whole lot better. And so with the detuning of the piano and as well as the other instruments that are playing with me, I created specific kinds of music for certain kinds of healing. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. For instance, one of the pieces is called At Horizon, and it definitely evokes that feeling of looking out over the horizon and meditating and getting that spiritual guidance and that feeling that you get when you look out over a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sun rising. Then there's a piece called Lullaby for Zaza. And this, I wrote this, you know, there's nothing, the child in us is where we always want to tap into, because that's where the innocence is in all of us. And so my daughter's name is Zahara, and so I would watch her and I would sit down and compose this piece, and it evokes that innocence and that tenderness and that honesty of a child. One of the other pieces is called Isis Rising. My youngest daughter's name is Isis. And I wrote this in a celebration of her birth, of her coming into the world. It's called Isis Rising. Then there's a piece called A Mother's Love, which I wrote that out of watching my wife care after, you know, the children. And all of these pieces, they have specific, they're written in specific keys for specific purposes, as I said earlier. For instance, when you talk about, there's a piece called Compassion, which I had actually written for you.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it in the same key that resonates with the heart. And
what key is that?
Well, this particular piece is in, this one's in A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, in A. Not the heart chakra, but the heart itself, the organ itself.
Uh-huh.
Then there's a mantra for love, which evokes the whole idea of using the ah syllable, which also resonates with the heart, the speech, and bringing in that love energy. I've used vocals on this particular piece as well. Also, Horizon, I actually use my wife's singing on that as well. She's doing a lot of the background vocals for that particular piece. Then there was a piece that came to me. I was doing some research with Randy, and got a hold of the frequency of the planets. And then from that, I began to research and went to the library, went on the internet, and found some frequencies and of what the planets actually sound like at certain times of the day. This particular frequency is the frequency that Jupiter makes at nightfall. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a piece called, because I'm a Sagittarius and I'm ruled by the planet, by Jupiter, I decided to do a piece in honor of the planet Jupiter. A lot of times we do things and we don't understand that we need to get permission from not only the universe, but the planets, and to communicate with the planets. Because they bring in, you know, specific energies of healing and all kinds of greatness. And so I decided to call that piece a Jazz on Jupiter.
Hmm. Nice. Well, you know, we've only got about a minute here.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any contact info you'd like to give out in case people are interested in your music?
Well, you can always go to Globe Institute, but you can also go to myastrology.net. That's myastrology, myastrology.net. Or you can just Google my name, Maestro Curtis.
Cool. Well, God, I really, really appreciate you coming on and talking about what you do. It's really,
yeah.
It's really fascinating. It's such a deep area. I mean, it's
been my pleasure.
The key to it all.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed this interview. It's been a pleasure.
You know, I want to reconnect with the energy of grounding and love. And may you all take this energy into the evening, into the rest of the weekend, into the next week, into the month, into the next years, and into many, many lifetimes. God bless you all. Take care. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
All right.